Good evening again, everybody. It is very nice to take this time to be together, especially to be together with this assignment to bring up the Dharma together. Because just thinking about the Dharma, talking about it, turning our attention to it, automatically brings a little bit of peace, a little bit of sanity into what probably is for all of us a very demanding world. It's possible, even likely, that the world has always been quite demanding for human beings, maybe even non-human beings also find the world demanding. Anyway, there's a Zen saying, and what do you call the world? After all, what is the world? The Buddha seemed to think that there was an inherent problem in being human, regardless of the state of the world. But he also thought that there was a solution to this basic problem. He insisted that regardless of the situation, regardless of conditions, that there is a way for us to practice peace and sanity, even in the world the way it is. Now or at any other time. We don't need to wait for a different world, another world. We're not waiting for utopia. We don't need to go to heaven. I mean, it would be nice to have a better world, and we should work for that. But whether we ever make a better world or not, even now, just as things are, and just as we are, we can find a way to live and to see life joyfully and with full confidence. Joe mentioned my book, When You Greet Me, I Bow, Notes and Reflections from the Life of Zen. And that's sort of around the themes of that book that I want to speak this evening. The book took, you could say, 40 years to write, in the sense that it's a collection of 40 years or so of essays that I've written about Dharma and related, all kinds of related issues. I've always been writing stuff ever since I was a kid. I'm not sure, you know, whether there's any noble purpose in it, whether it does anybody any good, all my chattering and my scribbling. One would hope always that one's activity is of some benefit, but you can't count on that, even you know. But probably just like you, I am the person that I am, and not someone else. And probably exactly like you, I did not place an order, on Amazon or anywhere else. Please send me this particular package of karma. I didn't order that. Somehow it was just delivered to my address. Anyway, I couldn't help it. We're all given such a delivery in this lifetime. And we have to answer for it and do the best we can with it. So, if you happen to be given to this habit of scribbling, which is somewhat embarrassing in many ways, but if you happen to have this habit and 30 or 40 years go by, you're going to have quite a stack of pages, right, that you have written inevitably. And so we collected essays over this period of 40 years, not all of them, but the ones that seem worth reprinting. And I'm really grateful to Cynthia Schrager, who is the editor of this book, because it was Cynthia who traced down all these essays, many of which were written before the internet days, when there were electronic records of texts. So she found all these essays and she made a selection from them. And then she, Cynthia is a really astute reader of texts. You know, reading is a skill, right? You learn how to read, you can read the words, but really understanding texts and being able to think about them clearly is quite a skill, and Cynthia has that skill. And she figured out that over all this time, I've been thinking about four subjects. She organized the essays into four batches. And those four batches are, first of all, relationships, relationship, dharma as relationship. So a bunch of the essays are about that. The second topic is the Buddhist teachings on emptiness, which I think are quite unique to Buddhism. A lot of the things that contemporary Western people like about Buddhism, why it seems to so seamlessly fit in with a contemporary understanding of life, has to do with the emptiness teachings, which resist any kind of doctrine and describe the world as radically interconnected and interactive. Those teachings were always very close to my heart from the very beginning of my practice, and so I've done a lot of writing about those teachings and their implications for the world. That's the second topic that I write about. And the third is culture, in the sense that Buddhism is a culture. You know, there's been so much research, meditation, that you can almost think of Buddhism could be reduced to a physiological exercise, meditation, which has certain effects on the body and so on and so forth, all of which, of course, is true. But fundamentally, Buddhism has always been culture. And meditation is a part of that culture, for sure. But in fact, not as important a part of it as we might think. And it's especially interesting when you consider that we Western modern and postmodern people are trying to make use in some way of a culture that comes from a very, very different context. Asia is quite different. Asian thoughts, the basis of Asian thought is quite different from Western thought. Plus, all the Buddhist teachings virtually was set forth long before the modern period. So not only is it a different culture, but it's a different, radically different historical period. And yet we're trying to understand these teachings so that we're pretty much guaranteed to misunderstand. So the question is, how are we misunderstanding them? Maybe we're misunderstanding them and making them better because we're misunderstanding them. Or maybe we're making them worse. And are we appropriating something that doesn't belong to us? And so on and so on and so on. So all these questions of culture have been of great interest to me. I think about culture. I'm a poet and poetry through various cultures and times. It's something that I'm thinking about all the time. In other words, when I say Buddhism is a culture, I mean it's a way of thinking, it's a way of talking about things, it's a way of living, it's a way of feeling your life. So what about all that? That's my third topic. I mean, when we practice Buddhism, we don't really think about that, right? We just listen to the teachings, we try to put them into practice, but we don't think about how that all works and how our cultural biases are influencing the way we practice. And the fourth topic I covered in these essays, and the fourth topic that Cynthia figured out I've been thinking about all this time, is engagement. Which is so important topic. How do we engage with our lives, engage with the world? Since there is really no way not to engage with the world, because the world is in us, right? You can't get away from the world. Wherever you go, the world is going to go with you. It's in your thoughts, it's in your language, it's in your body, it's in your emotions. So how do we engage with others? How do we engage with, these days we have to think about our responsibility as citizens, our responsibility as community members, family members. What does Dharma practice have to say about that, and how does it help us with all that? So these are the four themes in the book: relationship, emptiness teachings, cultural dialogue, cultural borrowing, and engagement. And in the book, it was Cynthia's idea, actually, for me to write new material that would serve as a kind of introduction or notes to each one of these four subjects. So although the book is in the name a collection of many years of essays, it also includes new material in which I reflect from the present moment, and I think I wrote it in late 2020. My notes, that's why it's called Notes and Reflections, because I write sort of informal, very personal notes about these four sheaves of essays. It's funny, you know, if you wrote something 30 years ago, of course, the world is completely different, right? The context in which that writing appeared is totally different from the context we're in now. Plus, you're a different person, right? You don't feel and think the same way today that you did 30 years ago. So it was really interesting to write these notes and see how I was thinking when I was a much younger person. And so many of the things that we now ponder about the world, we pondered so differently 30 and 40 years ago. Anyway, I want to, for tonight, go a little bit more deeply into the question of relationships. One of my persistent thoughts is that possibly more than anything else, the Dharma is about relationships. Actually, when you think about the emptiness teachings, what they really amount to is the insight that every moment is a moment of relationship. But relationship includes much more than what we usually think of as relationships. In Dharma, relationship includes solitude, it includes perception, it includes the mystery of the thinking and feeling mind, and the uncanny reality that we're living all the time, that things appear and fade away constantly. I can't get used to this. Just flabbergasted by it my entire life. What happened to yesterday? Where is it? How is it that time passes, every moment disappearing completely to make way for the next? The emptiness teachings are telling us that because of all this, there is nothing that we can have and hold on to, including, perhaps especially including ourselves. They say, quite radically, that there actually are no things, there is nothing but relationship. Every moment is a relation. Everything arises together and passes away together, but there are no things separate from this relation. There literally is nothing there but the rising and passing away of this interrelated world. So the title essay of the book is called When You Greet Me, I Bow. And that phrase comes from a Zen story. I'm going to read you actually two Zen stories from the opening essay about relationship. Here's the first one. Long Tan made rice cakes for a living. He was a baker. But when he met the priest Tian Huang, he was so impressed with his teachings that he closed up his bakery and joined Tian Huang's monastery. And Tian Huang said to him, "Good, be my attendant. And from now on, I will teach you the essential Dharma gate." A year passed, and Long Tan said, "When I arrived, you said you would teach me, but so far nothing has happened." And Tian Huang said, "What do you mean? I've been teaching you all along." Long Tan said, "What have you been teaching me?" Tian Huang said, "When you greet me, I bow. When I sit, you stand beside me. When you bring tea, I receive it from you." another story. One day, and this is another story taking place in a monastery. One day when Guishan was lying down, Yangshan came to see him, and Guishan said, "Let me tell you about my dream." And Yangshan leaned forward to listen. And then Guishan said, "Would you interpret my dream for me? I want to see how you do it." In response, Yangshan brought a basin of water and a towel. Guishan washed his face and sat up. Then Xiangyan entered the room. Guishan said to him, "Yangshan and I have been sharing miracles. This is no small matter." And Xiangyan said, "I know, I was next door and I heard you." Guishan said, "Why don't you try?" Yangshan made a bowl of tea and brought it to him. Guishan praised them both, saying, "You two students surpass even Shariputra and Moggallana with your miraculous activity." Shariputra and Moggallana being two leading disciples from the Buddhist time. So those are two stories that illustrate how I think of relationship in the light of Dharma. The stories certainly don't seem to match the idea that we have about relationships. When we say relationship, we mean two or more people engage with one another. Maybe they get along very well, maybe they have some trouble, maybe it's complicated, but that's what we mean by relationships. But that does not seem to be what these stories are about, although they are certainly about people relating to one another. They seem to be meeting one another on an entirely different plane with an entirely different set of assumptions. All of them are completely committed to and have fully entered the Dharma gate of deep truth, of awakening. And the thing is, they're doing it together. They're doing it interactively. All the Zen literature is actually an interactive literature about people sharing the Dharma together and awakening together. They are interacting with the Dharma rather than personality as the basis of their connection. No one has to fulfill anyone else's needs. They don't need to understand each other in the way that we want to understand each other. They don't even need to be kind and generous with each other. Somehow or other, you get the feeling that their interaction goes beyond that. It includes so much that is understood and unspoken. The Vipassana tradition is actually interesting because it's a new tradition. I always say, you know, I'm actually old friends with the founders of the Vipassana movement, Jack Kornfield and Joseph Goldstein and Sharon Salzberg. And, you know, I always say to them, "I can't believe what you guys did. And if you knew what you were doing, you never would have done it." And they said, "You're absolutely right. If we had any idea what we were doing, we never would have done this." They started a new religion in their 20s, you know, without really knowing that they were doing this. They took the Buddhism that they had learned from their teachers in Asia, and they took it out of its Asian context, and they said, "Let's just make this an American tradition." So they pretty much got rid of all the formality and all the Asian parts of the religion. In Zen practice, we didn't do that. Our teachers were here in the West with us, practicing with us. We didn't go to the East and come back to the West, leaving the teachers behind. They lived here with us. And so we practiced the forms that they transmitted to us. So we have a lot of formality. I'm sure all you understand, all of you know this, that in Zen, you know, we wear robes, we have clergy, we have ordination ceremonies, we do bowing, we do chanting. Our sitting practice is highly ritualized. And the idea in Zen practice is that that ritual container creates the atmosphere in which transcendent relationships like the ones that are described in the stories can take place. So what about that kind of relationship? I'll read you a poem that I recently reread, one of my favorite poets, Robert Creeley. I'm not sure in the world of poets, Robert Creeley is known by everyone. I'm not sure if you're not a major poetry person, whether you know Robert Creeley, but maybe you do. He was a wonderful person and just an unbelievable poet. And here's his poem called The Edge. So I'm going to read the poem and then say a few things about it, because I've been doing Dharma practice for so long, I'm totally brainwashed. And wherever I look, all I ever see is Dharma. So to me, this poem is full of Dharma. Creeley was not a Buddhist practitioner much, I don't think. But he was friends with all the meat writers, and many of them were Buddhist practitioners and very well aware of Buddhism, and I'm sure influenced by it. But whether or not he was, I see a lot of Dharma in this poem, The Edge. Long over whatever edge, backward, a false distance, here and now, sentiment. To begin again, forfeit in whatever sense an end, to give up thought of it, hanging on the weather's edge, hope, a sufficiency, thinking of love's accident, this long way come with no purpose, face again, changing these hands, feet, beyond me, coming home, an intersection, crossing of one and many, having all, having nothing, feeling thought, heart, head, generalities, all abstract, no place for me or mine. I take the world and lose it, miss it, misplace it, put it back or try to, can't find it, fool it, even feel it. The snow from a high sky, gray, floats down to me softly. This must be the edge of being before the thought of it blurs it. Can only try to recall it. It's a haunting poem, right? Like all good poems, you can't exactly say, what is he saying? I think it's a poem about the real world we live in, that we mostly miss the real world that these people in the Zen stories are aware they're living in and relate to one another on the basis of it. The edge. It begins with the word edge. Long over whatever edge, backward, a false distance, here and now, sentiment. An edge of something, you know, it's as if the edge is dangerous. You might fall off, or it's as far as you can go. It's out to the edge. It's backing off of the edge, backing away from the edge of our experience. It's a false distance, he says. And yet, the only place we ever live is here and now. And it's here and now that gives us the opportunity to go past that edge. Begin again, forfeit, in whatever sense, an end, to give up thought of it. Whenever there's a person, you know, there's an end. Whenever there's an experience, there's an end. But what if we didn't see that end, but only saw its presence? What if we knew that all the things we think about our lives are false? And that we drive ourselves crazy with our misconceptions and misperceptions, hanging on the weather's edge. And this poem, as you'll see by the end, and as we have seen already in reading it, is about the weather in some strange way, the weather as being so present to us. Our body every day reacts to the weather in ways that we're not even aware of. And nowadays, it's so amazing to me, really, that the weather, which we just sort of took for granted, now has become an existential issue for humanity, right? The climate, which has a mind of its own, it turns out. Becomes something that we look at every day and think about every day in terms of our being human. Hanging on the weather's edge. We are all now hanging on the weather's edge. Hope, a sufficiency, thinking of love's accident. Love comes anywhere, you know. That's why we can have happiness, joy in our lives, no matter how messed up the world is and how worried we are about it. Because love appears anyway, accidentally. That's the only way it appears. And that is sufficient. And there's always hope in there, even though we're hanging on the other's edge. Long way come with no purpose. Face again, changing these hands, feet beyond me. Did you ever think of that, you know? Your face, how it's changed, you know, over these many years of you being alive. Sometimes you look at a picture of yourself 40, 50 years ago. Who is that person? How did it happen? Now you look in the mirror. What happened? How did that take place? Your hands, your feet. Whose are they? Hands and feet, you know, are so characteristic of a person. They express so much. Beyond you. Who coming home, an intersection, crossing of one and many, having all, having nothing. This is like the interconnection that I spoke about, that is being itself. Being alive is like constantly being in an intersection. You know, the light is changing and everybody's walking in all directions, somehow or other meeting in the middle as they pass each other. And so in this radical interactive life that we're all living, we're all the wealthiest person in the world. There's nothing that exists that is not ours. And at the same time, we have nothing. Our house, our bank account doesn't belong to us. Our body even doesn't belong to us. It has its own mind, right? Our body has its own mind. Because maybe there'll be a time when we'll say, okay, don't die. But the body says, sorry, doing it anyway. Or maybe we say, oh no, I can't do this. I can't, I'm so scared. I cannot die. And the body says, don't worry about a thing. I know exactly what to do. Very scary, I would think. I don't know, but I would think it'd be a very scary thing to die. But everybody can do it. How can they all do it? You'd think somebody would not be able to do it. I can't face it. I can't do it. But no, 100% of the people can do that. It's really quite extraordinary when you think about it. And that's because their body knows how to do it, even though they don't. These hands, feet, face again changing beyond me. Feeling, thought, heart, head, generalities, all abstract. No place for me or mine. The way we live our lives. This is a very radical thought that was very much the Buddhist thought. When he said all conditioned existence has the nature of suffering, he was saying, we don't know what we're doing. Our thinking process, our way of conceiving of the world is wrong-headed, and it's causing us to suffer. He didn't mean like just change a few ideas. He meant revise completely your sense of self and world, because we're living generalities and abstractions. And because of that, there is no real place for us. I take the world and lose it, miss it, misplace it, put it back or try to, can't find it, fool it, even feel it. The Zen question, you know, what is the world? Do we know? Think how upset we get over the state of the world, and we have no idea what the world is. We can't even find it. We can't fool it. It fools us. We lose it. We misplace it. Where is it? Is it under the bed somewhere? The snow from a high sky. Gray. Floats down to me softly. And to me, this is the most brilliant thing about this poem. And Freely was very careful about these little words. And I love this in my poems. I love little words. He doesn't say, this snowflake floats down on me. Probably we would say that. A snowflake fell down on me. But he says, a snowflake floats down to me. Very different, right? Because he's in relation to this snowflake. It's not just a mechanical thing flying down from the sky. The snowflake comes to him. And he receives the snowflake as if it came to him. And that's how it is with the world. The world comes to us. It's not this dead abstraction outside of us. It comes to us every moment of perception and thought. And when we realize that the world comes to us like a snowflake falling from a high gray sky, we feel very differently about it. There's more love there. There's more wonder. We're not so worried. And then, The Edge, which is the title of the poem, and appears in the first line, comes back now in the final short stanza. This poem is written in three-line stanzas. This must be the edge of being before the thought of it. This must be the edge of being before the thought of it, blurs it, can only try to recall it. So this snowflake coming to him is the edge of being alive before we have a chance to think about it, before we have a chance to make it into something. Trying to recall so that we could have what we cannot have, our experience of a lifetime. So I think that in our meditation practice, I don't think we even know this is going on. But in my opinion, what it's about is it's breaking up the ice, you know, inside of us, created by our conditioning, our education, our family, all the things that we need, that we prize and love, also creates a kind of rigidity within us that causes our suffering and our misperception. Meditation is softening us up in some profound way that we might not even be aware of. Softening us up so that the world can come to us more softly and our sense of self can be softer within us. We're not so upset with ourselves or worried about ourselves. It's always okay if we're willing to live and die, right? And we are living and dying all the time. How else did we get this face? That's 50 years different from the face of 50 years ago. Where did that come from? It came from time passing, falling away. So that's what I mean by relationship. A relationship to one another in the light of our practice, a relationship to the world in the light of our practice, a relationship to ourself in the light of our practice, our relationship to our life, to our death, to love itself in the light of our practice. So that's what I wanted to share with you tonight.